this is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, The Magic of Energy. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You never create or destroy energy. You only convert it from one form to another.
That's Clifford Johnson. He's a professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Southern California.
There's a fundamental law, perhaps one of the most fundamental laws in physics, is what's called conservation of energy, which is precisely this idea that it changes from one form to another, but you never really destroy it or create it.
Even though we know that energy can't be created, there's always been that dream. Could we defy these laws of physics? Get something for nothing?
Maybe I could just sort of magically create some energy from nowhere.
The closest thing we have to a magical power source is the sun. It sits out there in space and sends out a constant stream of energy. But Clifford says even the sun doesn't create energy from nothing. All that energy comes from a process called nuclear fusion. It releases stored energy, like with other energy sources.
At the chemical level, when you look at the fire burning, what are you doing when you burn that coal or that wood? You're actually releasing energy that's stored in chemical bonds. You set it going, you light a match or what have you, set it going, and so then a chemical reaction starts.
You need some power to get it going.
But then the whole process unleashes stored energy in the chemical bond, so you get more out.
Fusion gets to that stored energy by fusing atoms together.
What you're doing is you're taking two kinds of nuclei, and you push them into each other, and they form a new nucleus. They bind together. They fuse. That's where the word fusion comes from. And it turns out that when you form the new thing, there's energy left over when you change from the two separate ones to the one new one. When they bind together, they give up what's called the binding energy. It doesn't mean that you've created energy. It's just that it's a mechanism of release. So how much do you put in to get the whole thing going? And then once it gets going, the magic happens. It's not magic, it's science. but out comes that stored energy. And the marvelous thing about nuclear fusion is that you can release a lot of energy in a small amount of matter.
But replicating what the sun does here on Earth is very difficult.
The problem is pushing these things together. So that's the match in this case. And you actually need some initial energy because these things want to repel each other. You need some extra energy to push them together. And that's the whole problem with fusion. You need to find ways of squeezing these things together and confining them in a controlled way. And also the whole thing then gets very, very dangerous in the sense that it is these things in their pure form, if they touched anything in that process, would sort of destroy it. So you need a way of holding it all together. So you need what's called a containment system.
The matter that system has to contain is plasma.
So you have this fluid or gas of charged particles, which is an inherently volatile thing because that charge, it wants to balance out that charge. So if it comes into contact with other things, it's going to be trying to strip the charge off those things. And also it's quite hot because you want it to be at high temperature so that these nuclei bump into each other and fuse.
Fusion has been a bit of a scientific unicorn chase that's been going on for decades. But there's one project that claims to be finally getting closer to harnessing that sun-like energy. Reporter Grant Hill looked into it.
Nuclear physicist Mark Henderson says if we wanted it badly enough, fusion power could be ready for prime time in just 20 years.
If we put the money, we put the effort, and we put the ingenuity behind it.
It being a functional nuclear fusion energy reactor that could produce usable electricity.
But we would have to be committed to doing that. And governments would have to be committed to putting the success of fusion first.
He hopes the project he's been working on for the last dozen years will give fusion power that push.
ITER will be the world's largest experimental facility to demonstrate the scientific and technical feasibility of fusion power.
ITER stands for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. It's often called the world's largest science experiment and the next step in our journey to fusion energy.
ITER is the Latin word for the way.
The way.
The way.
Still under construction in the south of France, the huge donut-shaped fusion test reactor is a product of diplomacy. In the 1980s, two longtime foes, the US and USSR, came together with a common mission to harness the seemingly magical power source for something other than mutual annihilation. It didn't take long for other countries to join, and in 2001, the final design for the project was approved. All in all, 35 countries are splitting the cost of ITER. The final price tag is still up for debate. If you ask ITER, the bill will run around $25 billion. The U.S. Department of Energy puts it at nearly $65 billion. But who really cares about all that public money when the payoff is proof that virtually unlimited energy is actually feasible, right? A sun in a bottle we can tap whenever we need it.
Fusion is a practical source of energy, and that fusion would be commercially viable. That's what we were promised.
Well, Stephen Krivet, a science writer and private investigator, is here to rain on our stellar keg stand.
Even though there are many interesting things to learn about fusion research, the only thing that really matters to people, the only thing that really matters to the world, is whether fusion can be a source of energy. That means whatever power you need to put into the reactor device to make it operate, you have to get out a lot more power than the power that you put into the machine to make it work. If the output rate isn't a lot higher than the input rate, it's maybe scientifically curious, but it's practically useless.
Stephen is not a formally trained physicist like Mark. He doesn't have a degree in nuclear anything. But a couple of decades ago, Stephen got really into fusion energy. So he just started showing up at random conferences and chatting with whoever would speak to him. Eventually, he turned a ton of those conversations at a whole bunch of conferences into the New Energy Times, a website where he reports on developments in fusion. Since then, he's lectured at NASA and authored three books. And it was during the editing process for one of those books in 2014 that Stephen discovered something that sort of broke his brain.
I just stumbled on what I found here. It was an accident.
Stephen knew ITER had made a bold promise to produce 10 times the amount of energy it consumed. 10 times. Even though ITER was only a test reactor, which wouldn't achieve its goals until at least 2035, such a result would be a record-smashing number for fusion reactors compared to its predecessor, a test reactor called JET in the UK. That one couldn't even break even, meaning it produced less power than it consumed. ITER slapped this 10 times power gain claim all over its website and marketing materials.
800 cubic meters of burning plasma was to generate 500 megawatts of power, about 10 times as much as was needed to heat the plasma.
The number that describes the ratio of energy in, energy out, is called the Q ratio. Energy needed to heat the plasma inside the reactor versus energy generated by the resulting fusion reaction. But when Stephen needed to double-check some figures for his book, he said a closer look at the Q ratio, ITER promised, revealed something concerning.
I assumed that everybody knew the rate of power that went into these reactors. But the scientists that I spoke to said, well, actually, we don't measure the rate of power that goes into the fusion reactors. And I'm going, what are you talking about? We all thought that the rate of power that you talk about was a comparison of the power coming out versus the power coming in. And they said, no, that power ratio doesn't compare the rate of power coming out versus the power coming in. It only compares the ratio of the power that's used to heat the fuel versus the thermal power that's produced by the fuel.
So it really only speaks to what happens deep inside the reactor when fusion happens, not the energy it takes to run the whole operation, or the actual usable energy that could be produced. Stephen was confused.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is a pretty serious misunderstanding that I had, that everybody else that I know had.
As far as he knew, everybody had understood the ratio to mean 10 times more usable energy produced than it takes to run the entire reactor. So the first thing Stephen did was get in touch with the scientists at JET, the UK reactor that held the previous record for Q. He wanted to find out the ratio for total electrical power input versus total electrical power output had the reactor been connected to the grid.
The efficiency is 1%.
1%. Far from the 67% Stephen thought it was. That means if JET was hooked up to the grid, the reactor would lose almost all the power it used to operate.
My first reaction was, oh, shit. There's a real serious discrepancy here.
So, what did all of this mean for ITER and its claim to have a Q ratio of 10? What did that really mean then? Everywhere the Q ratio was talked about, people seemed to understand it the same way Stephen had. Take a listen to these 2014 congressional hearings.
At this day and age, and now is the right time to build and operate experiments that can finally demonstrate that a man-made fusion system can consistently produce far more energy than it takes to fuel it. ITER is designed to produce at least 10 times the energy it consumes.
It is now possible to actually build a full-scale test reactor that produces far more energy than it uses.
Stephen says it was reported that way.
If you look at the 2017 New York Times story, if you look at news stories in Nature, Wall Street Journal, New Scientist, before all of these news outlets reported that the rate of power that ITER would require to operate was 50 megawatts.
50 megawatts in for 500 megawatts out. So will ITER actually produce 10 times more energy than it consumes? The answer depends on what you mean by energy.
Well, the Q is one of the confusions on this factor is that there's really a Q physics, and to some degree, there's a Q engineering.
That's Mark Henderson again, the nuclear physicist who works at ITER. I asked him what this was all about and why there was confusion. He said physicists and non-physicists think of Q differently.
So for me to put in 50 megawatts of power, I need to pull from the grid about 150 megawatts. And so an engineer would say, well, Mark, wait a minute, you know, you're pulling 150 megawatts from the grid, you convert it to 50 megawatts, that gives me 500 megawatts out. But then those 500 megawatts are going to heat water that turns a turbine that then generates electricity that would put back to the grid roughly 150 megawatts. So from an engineer's perspective, if ITER was a fusion reactor, it would be giving a Q engineering roughly of about 1.
A Q physics ratio of 10, but a Q engineering ratio of 1. Not 10, 1. Mark even doubted if actual engineers who work on fusion sites correctly understood this difference, let alone the public. But it's an important difference nonetheless.
That means the ITER reactor is effectively a zero power reactor.
That's Stephen again.
If the design works as expected, we're going to get the same rate of power coming out as the power going in. Zero extra power that would be available to use for any practical purposes.
He notes that if ITER was hooked up to the grid, it would effectively be a massive, expensive, complicated, scientifically remarkable extension of electrical wire. But, of course, ITER was never going to be hooked up to the grid anyway. It's just a test reactor. So that in itself isn't a huge issue. To Stephen, the issue is one of misrepresentation. He argues ITER should have known Q physics was going to be misunderstood by the public, that language regarding power output and Q was always way too squishy for non-experts to reach any other conclusion than that Q and fusion power and output referred to usable energy rather than heated plasma, especially when those terms were so often cited in the context of virtually unlimited energy as a feasible solution to our impending climate crisis that deserved more funding. But Mark, the ITER physicist, argues if there was confusion, it was all just a misinterpretation. There was no purposeful misrepresentation.
It is very easy in any field to be misinterpreted. And unfortunately, it's easier for people to take pot shots at fusion just because the amount of invested money to build a machine, the longevity of building a machine, people will say, well, why are you building a fusion reactor compared to, for example, putting the money into a solar field or to a wind field? And my answer is to say that, you know, we should be looking at a short-term objective and a long-term objective.
Still, though, on stage in Vienna in 2019 at a TED Talk entitled The Dawn of the Fusion Age, Mark did it himself. He cited the 10-time power gain without any further explanation of what it really meant.
At this point, we've decided to work together in a large environment where all nations are coming together, combining resources to build ITER. That's where I work. It's in the south of France. And our goal is to build a machine that performs 10 times better. So we have 1 watt going in equals 10 watts out.
There it is. 1 watt in equals 10 watts out. Technically true. But did the audience of non-physicists know he was talking about heating plasma and thermal power? Or did they assume he was talking about overall electrical power?
I don't like conveying information in a way that could be misinterpreted. And I think one of the key issues in communication is to be able to understand who your audience is and to convey that, give that audience enough information to be able to understand what this thing called capital Q is. So obviously, fusion has hurt itself in how the Q, capital Q, has been interpreted in the community or in public.
Mark said a commercial fusion reactor will need a Q of about 40, 4 times the Q of ITER, to actually generate sufficient power to be viable. So why all the fuss about Q equals 10 from ITER? Michelle Claessens was the communications director for ITER for about 5 years and wrote a book about the project. He puts the whole Q thing pretty bluntly.
People just accepted this, and because it was, let's say, a good selling argument, voila. It went through the system.
Michelle said it took a while to correct the representation of Q on ITER's own website, and to him, it's still a bit vague. The current head of communications for ITER, Laban Koblenz, told me the organization does not believe there is any public misunderstanding of the Q ratio, nor does it believe its representation of Q was vague or incorrect. In the meantime, Stephen Krivet reached out to the organizations who had published the Q ratio without an explanation of what it meant. He's edited ITER Wikipedia pages to better explain Q, and personally emailed ITER member organizations from all over the world to get the number changed on their sites.
And the thing is, nobody has ever disagreed with me. All of these people that I contacted in these organizations, nobody's ever argued with me about the power values. Never.
That story was reported by Grant Hill.